Hello everyone, I am Karen. And I too am a grateful member of Al-Anon. Now I'm going to look, it says 22 minutes after 10. Help me with that because I might forget when I started. Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting us to Atlanta. And we think we've been here before, but we sort of are forgetting where we've been, you know. I guess there are people who have sort of a shrine to themselves that they have pins in a map where they have been. Now I'm kind of sorry we didn't do that, John. We throw, as soon as we get home, we throw everything away and start new. We were taken to that fabulous market yesterday. Where's John? There you are. Okay. John Cornelius. Don't you love that name, Cornelius? I know I'm breaking your anonymity. With a name like that, I would do it all the time. He took us there, and we had a wonderful time there with all that food. Well, I'm going to start right in. I hope there are some new people in Al-Anon here. And you know, in Al-Anon, we're new much longer than you're new in AA. In our big AA meeting down where we have attended for over 30 years, they ask for new people who have been sober less than 30 days to stand up and give their name. And after that, after 30 days, they don't have to do that. But in our meetings, I don't know, we just don't seem to. We come in and then people go out again, and I don't know if we're not as sincere as the AAs are, or I know for one thing we usually don't have the law looking for us, so maybe that has something to do with it. But if you're new and you have come in here to Al-Anon in order to find a way to sober somebody up, I think that's one of the best motivations of all for coming to Al-Anon. It won't work, but you're here and you've got to find some answers for yourself. And when I was new, one of the first things they told me was that it wasn't my fault. Oh, I love that. I mean, Johnny regularly told me no wonder he had the drink, you know, being married to me. So I like that. But then the next thing they told me was that I was sick. Sicker maybe than the alcoholic. Now that really made me mad, you know, really. But then, you know, it's okay if you're sick when you come into Al-Anon. It's okay if you're full of fear and anger and despair. I'd really worry about you if you came in serene and happy. You know, that would be strange. I mean, you almost have to be on something. You know? That also happens. Well, I know the room isn't so deep. You can hear me. I was born long, long ago, far, far away. In Lapland, in Sweden, about 50 miles north of the Arctic Circle. My father was building a railroad up there. And we lived there, and my father drank. I mean, all those railroad men drank on weekends and partied. There was always parties and singing and dancing and laughter, a lot of fun. But ever since I was real small, I had this great need to shape up the people around me. And if anybody laughed too loud or sang too loud, I'd tell them about it. So I got sent to my room a lot. My father was a huge man. Not so heavy as this big, and my mother was a darling woman. She, I don't know, she had some sort of bee in Al-Anon, I swear. She took it so easy with my dad. But much of the time he was a lot of fun. He drove big Harley Davidson motorcycle, and he had pontoons on it. You know, there was a lot of snow, and he had a sidecar, and sometimes he'd pick my sister and me up and put us in that and take us along. And he taught us how to ski. That was very important up there. But when he had been drinking, I had no use for him. And I don't know how I knew so well. I remember we had a little dog that was just crazy about my dad. And he'd run to meet him, you know, when he heard the motorbike. And he'd get just 20 feet within, and something told him, and he'd run back and hide, you know. And I was the same way. We moved to Stockholm, which is the big city in Sweden, the capital, when I was 10 years old. And for a while there, my father didn't drink. I realize now that he was probably periodic, because he had periods when he wouldn't drink, and then he would take an interest in my sister and me. And he'd take us places. He did that when we came down to Stockholm. He was originally from there, and he taught us how to get along in the city, and he took us to the library and museums and thought about teaching us things. But then when he'd start drinking again, all that fell away. And I can remember my mom telling me, "Now that he's coming home, please don't say anything. Just go to your room or go to a friend's house." And my dad would come in, and he was really true for the day. He was happy if you could just go to bed. But I couldn't let him do that. If I had to prop him up, I was going to tell him what his drinking did to me. And I got into a lot of tight corners that way. And my mom had to hustle me out of the house many times. I quit school when I was 15 because of his drinking. And of course, it took me all the way into Al-Anon to recognize that for what it was. I wanted to quit school. I wanted to get a job. I wanted to be independent. And I wanted to dress like June Allison and Gloria Haven dress. That kind of tells you where I come from. But of course, I couldn't make any kind of money to buy dresses on, so I went back to school, but I had a little night job. I lied about my age, and I got a job in selling chocolates in one of those movie houses. And that was fine with me. I actually liked school. I had an easy time at school. But I also liked having a little money. So that's how I live now. It allowed me not to date. I wasn't asked very much, so that took care of that. But the summer I was 17, I was working in an office in Stockholm, and one of the southern branch people came up to work with us. He was absolutely gorgeous. He looked sort of dangerous. I remember that, thinking that. He was very dark, dark eyes, and beautifully dressed, and beautiful manners. That was when manners were in, believe me. all of the women in the office, we whispered and wondered about this fellow, and we used to straighten our seams when he came along. Like, you'll have to explain that to the kids. But he liked me, and we began to have lunch together and go on breaks together. All summer long we did that. And then in September he had his birthday, and he said to me, "What do you do on Saturday night?" And I said, "I go dancing at the Winter Palace." Doesn't that sound good? And it was like the Hollywood Palladium. And they had a big orchestra that played all the Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and, you know, Artie Shaw, all that good stuff. And he said, "I'll come and dance with you." And he did. And that was the beginning. he was from the south. We have a south in Sweden too. And he spoke with a different dialect than I did, you know, quite different. In fact, he came from a town very close to Denmark, and it sounded almost Danish to me, so I had a little trouble understanding what he said sometimes. In fact, a couple of times I said yes when I ought to have said no. Moving right along. In about 6 months we were engaged, and a year after that we were married. And of course the most marvelous part about this man was that he didn't drink. And I had promised myself, and I had promised my father, that when I met someone, it would be someone who didn't drink. And yet, okay. So, and when we had been married a few months, Johnny came to me and said, how would you like to go to America? And I knew all my dreams were coming true. It was one thing, I wanted to learn to speak English. And when John said we were going to Los Angeles, I knew it. We were going to be in Van Johnson's backyard, you know. So we came out to California, and drinking was not a part of our life. We were busy becoming Americans, and we had our first child, a little girl, after we'd been here a year. And when she was 3 years old, we should go back to Sweden and show her off. And our families really wanted us back again. But we already loved America. I don't know. We were homesick. We were so homesick sometimes that we never even talked about it together. It was about 15 years we had been here when, at a party, I overheard Johnny say how sometimes he'd been so homesick. And I said, you were? So we went to Sweden. And in those days, we went by ship from New York. So John's people in New York said to us, now when you go across, instead of taking Dramamine for seasickness, why don't you drink scotch? And I'll tell you what I said when they said that. I said, what a wonderful idea. I had forgotten all about how I disliked drinking, you know. And so we did. We drank scotch on that ship over. And when we came to Sweden, people were having parties for us, and we had a wonderful time. And by the time we got back to the States, and John had an expense account, a job with an expense account, we really got serious about having fun. And we took people out, and they took us out, and we had parties and went to parties. And we had so much fun that in no time at all we had 4 children. And by that time we had moved down to Corona del Mar. It's a little town very close to Laguna. And during the week I'd be on the beach with the kids. And then on the weekends we'd hire a babysitter and we'd go off and party. Could I have a glass of water? I get a little rusty. Oh, thank you. You have to excuse me. Well, that went on for a few years. And then I started to have second thoughts about this drinking business. We could behave ourselves at a party, but you know, with that kind of life, what goes on, there's flirtations and accusations and recriminations, and we could behave ourselves at a party, and by the time we hit that car, we started to argue, and then the fight was in full flight by the time we got home. And, I had a long talk with John, the first of many. And I said, you know, this drinking life, it's no good. It isn't good for us, and it isn't good for the children, and we're going to give it up. And John asked me to run along. He wasn't interested in my plan at all. And we still went out, and we still went to parties, but now I couldn't relaxing. I couldn't have any fun because I had to watch what he was doing. Because now it became a contest, you know. If I could count all the drinks and watch all the women he was talking to, and you know. We moved to Anaheim at that time, and that's a little inland from the beach. And those people, we came into a new tract of homes. We were all young couples with young children, and these people were more serious than the beach crowd, and they belonged to churches, and they were civic-minded, and they took the children to all the right, you know, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. And I wanted us to fit in with them, you know. And by this time, John was a daily drinker, and he has no trouble talking to people. He's very gregarious, and he'd visit all those homes back and forth, you know, up and down the streets with his own bottle. I mean, he wasn't taking any chances by that time. And of course, that embarrassed me totally. And the years that followed were about 5-6 years of this that was just... we tell it now, it's kind of funny, but it wasn't funny then, and it made me sicker and sicker by the day. And I can remember I was always trying to improve my mind. I thought somebody has to do something, you know. So I was reading American literature, and I had been reading Sinclair Lewis, and one of his stories tells about a family who had a drunk, and they locked him in the attic. I mean, they just put food down for him, you know. And I thought, that's what I want to do with John. I really seriously considered that. Of course, I'd let him out to go to work, but I mean... I'll just tell this one episode. It tells the whole story, how Johnny was. First of all, he used to invite people over to have drinks when he was mowing the lawn, and everybody was putting everything in, you know, we came to this new track. So everybody was out working, so that was a good time for John to call everybody over and try to have a drink with him, you know, while he was mowing the lawn. And some of them would come, but most of them had things to do. But then one day, one woman came over to our house and said, "Have you seen Bonnie?" And I said, "Well, let me look." Because we had so many little children, and they were in and out of the house. And sometimes your children weren't there, but somebody else's was, you know. So I checked in the bedroom. "No," I said, "she isn't here." "Okay," she said. And of course, Johnny was there. And he said, "What do you mean? She's lost?" "Yeah, we find her." And he took on, you know, big drama. And he said, "We can't have this little girl lost." And he got on his, of course, he took his drink with him. And on Katrina's little Stingray, 16-inch wheel bike, you know, here's Johnny going up down the street. "Bonnie," you know. I mean, we lost a kid a day in that neighborhood. It was no big deal, you know. You know, but he blew it out of proportion. And then he came home and he said, "Have they found her?" Well, I said, "I don't know." Well, he filled up his drink and took off. And, you know, spectacles, one after the other. Well, I did get very sick very soon. And I think what happened to me was that all my resentment and anger about my father's drinking had sort of gone underground when I met John. And I thought, I'm not going to have to live like my mother and stand by the window and wait and being stood up all the time. My life was going to be different, and here it was the very same thing. And I know sometimes the only way I could function was on anger. If I was angry, I could get my work done, you know, but if I really let myself realize what our life had become, I just couldn't move. And once in a while, I'd tell one of the neighbors, you know, about what was going on, and then I'd go home, and then I'd start feeling disloyal, and then I'd start thinking, now she knows about us, and then I'd resent her. I wouldn't see her anymore. And I went through one after the other of the women in that neighborhood till finally I was alone. And even John could see that I was in trouble. And we had one more of our talks. We regularly fought and talked and made up and started over, you know. And so this time he said, you know, I'm going to give up this drinking. It isn't worth it to me to see what it's doing to you. And he said, in 3 weeks' time, I'll have these jobs finished and we'll take a little trip. We'll go to Palm Springs and we'll have a wonderful time. And you know, those 3 weeks were wonderful. The children began to relax around him, and I knew we were going to be all right. You know, we started to take our walks at night, and we were going to be fine. On the morning when we should leave for Palm Springs, when I woke up, Johnny was drunk. He'd started to drink during the night, and it really threw me. I couldn't believe it. And I thought we shouldn't go, he shouldn't drive. But then we went anyhow. And it was a disaster. He drove much too fast. And we came to Palm Springs and he should take us to a restaurant and he fell in the restaurant and it was so bad. And I tried to take my life that weekend. You see, I had figured it out. There had been a serious love before me and I thought Johnny was unhappy because he hadn't married that other girl. And he couldn't tell me and that's why he drank. Never spoke about this with him. I just figured it out all by myself. I did a lot of figuring out all by myself. And also, on that trip home, I had said some really hurtful things to my dad, and I thought, I do everything wrong, and I knew I wasn't paying enough attention to the children because I was always worrying about what he was doing and where he was. So I thought everybody would be better off. Well, I got very sick. And eventually we got home to Anaheim again. And soon after that, our minister came to call on us. And I sure didn't want him to know about how we lived, you know. Those women in the church had invited me to join their guilds. And I used to think, oh, you don't understand. You don't know how we scream at each other at home and how we live. You don't want me in your association. But he was so kind and thoughtful that I began to tell him about my father's drinking, and pretty soon I was telling him about John's drinking. And he said to me, why don't you come and talk with me for an hour once a week? And he said, if you can get Johnny to come, he can have another hour. And I thought, oh, he'll never do that. He's so selfish. But the next day I told John about it, and Johnny said, well, how kind of him, of course I'll go. And that surprised me. Well, now we were both getting help, and it did help to go and talk to that man. We didn't fight so much anymore. It took some of the pressure off. But it was a whole year later that I had been to see the minister one morning, and when he said to me, yes, I do think John is an alcoholic. Now, I had thought of John as an alcoholic for several years already. It was no secret to me. But when the minister said it, it seemed more serious. And he put it this way to me. He said, if he is an alcoholic, he'll have 3 ways to go. He'll either go crazy from it, or he will die from it, or he can get help. Well, I never even registered that last part about the help. And I can still remember how I felt walking home from his study that morning. I finally understood I wasn't going to be able to fix John. Nothing I said or did made any difference. But I even understood the minister couldn't do it because here it was a year later and Johnny was still drinking. But I think I even understood that Johnny couldn't fix it because in that year I had seen him try to quit several times. And he would just last a few days. And I think something happened to me that morning. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now because I see it happen in Al-Anon when people come in and have somebody still out there. I gave up. I just gave up. And that was not my style at all. And I think that has to happen to us non-alcoholics. We have to get out of the way. I don't mean physically, but mentally. We have to, if we have a higher power, they have a higher power. And as long as we're in their story, it seems nothing can happen. I was called back to Sweden at that time. My father was ill and tickets were sent for me and my little boy. I have 3 girls and a boy. And the minister said, we'll find someone to look after them and they'll be all right with their father. And so I did go to Sweden. I have later found out that he took them with him to his favorite bar and had them drink Shirley Temple. They thought it was wonderful. Anyway, while I was in Sweden, I realized that I knew I couldn't live with the drinking much longer. My father was still drinking, and it made me so angry, and I was so full of anger and resentment that I knew I could remember one night when we had been fighting, and of course Johnny passed out, and I stood there and I thought, I wonder if I can hold his pillow over his face, you know, long enough. And that, I mean, this is the father of my 4 children, my husband. Anyway, I knew I would have to learn to go to work. So when I got back to LA, I got myself a half-time job, a half-day job. And this is going to pick up a little bit. It was going straight to hell, you know. The man I worked for was a very successful insurance agent. And he would come flying into his office every morning in his 3-piece suit, and he looked so spiffy. And Johnny used to look like that, you know, but he didn't anymore. He kind of shuffled when he walked, you know. And I'm not above doing a little knifing when I think I have some ammunition, so I'd hold this fellow up to John and say that if he could be like him, you know, we might have something. Well, John has been that man's sponsor for the last 25 years. Central office called and asked him to go out to one of our honor farms, and there he was, and Johnny said, there isn't justice after all. And he'd take me to work in the morning, and then we'd try to say a few civil words to each other, nothing deep, you understand. And by the time he picked me up in the afternoon, he came straight from the bar and he was drunk. And we used to stop at the liquor store on the way home to pick up the evening supplies. And it was there in the parking lot one night, Johnny said to me, you see that guy over there with the brown paper sack? And I said, yes. He said, he's an alcoholic. I said, how do you know that? Every day when I'm here, he is here. Well, I said we weren't fighting much anymore, and we weren't. Not very much was going on at our house. You know, I'd come home and get dinner and get the kids situated so they could go to school in the morning, and that was about it. And then we'd sleep and go back and do the same thing the next day. But it was time for Carolyn's open house. Carolyn was our oldest child. She was 13. And John always insisted on coming to the children's functions. I think he thought he couldn't be as bad as I said he was if he did that, you know. And of course, he was a pain to have along. I mean, it was the worst thing I knew. He'd be weaving, you know, and you could smell the whiskey clear across the room, and I was always afraid he's going to put his hand on one of the teachers, you know, those cute darling teachers they have for the little kids, and oh, I was a nervous wreck, you know. And so now it's time to go to open house, and Johnny said, well, let's get ready, you know, it's time for open house. And I said, "Oh, John, you look so tired. Why don't you stay home tonight?" Well, then he had to go, of course. But then Carolyn spoke up. And you know, our children never participated in our quarrels. They never said anything to the dad. But Carolyn said, "Dad, I don't want you to come to my school. You're a drunk and you always embarrass me." And Johnny slapped her across the face, and it stopped us all three. I mean, that had never happened before. And I turned into that 13-year-old. You know, I remember how it was in my home. And I thought to myself, "My God, this is my first teenager. I have three more coming along." And you know, while they're little, you can kind of say, "Oh, daddy's tired. Why don't you leave him alone?" And you can do little things like that. But once they're teenagers, they have to say something on their honor, I think. So a few days went by, and then we had one of our talks again. And I said to Johnny, "You know, this cannot happen again. I want you to move out. Either you have to go down and try that Alcoholics Anonymous that the minister has talked about, or you have to move out. I'm not going to have the children get used to being slapped around." And I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I didn't know the one about don't make threats you don't intend to carry out. We just continued as before. And then one night Johnny came home and he said, "Let's talk." And he told me, "I'm not drinking anymore." And I said, "You're not?" "No," he said, "I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't think I have to drink again." And, you know, here it was. For all the times I'd said, "If you just quit drinking..." I did manage to say, Johnny tells you when he talks, that I said, "Your eyes look different." And that was certainly God's grace, because I know what I thought when he said he wasn't drinking anymore. Not even in the garage. I mean, that was how I was, you know. You were never going to put anything over on me. So, but... But here it was. Here he had quit drinking, and I didn't even look. I made a point never to look at John's eyes. I never wanted to be happy again, you know, because it was so difficult when he'd start in drinking again. And we were young. Johnny was 41. I was 35. And so now, when he came to pick me up at work every day, he was full of stories about Alcoholics Anonymous and about the Yolanda Club in Anaheim. And then he began to tell me about Charlie. And he said, "Guess what this Charlie told me today? And this is what Charlie says. And Charlie said this." And I said, "Well, bring him home." I wanted to meet him. I wanted to see what he had that I didn't have. I'd said some of those things too, you know. So one night here after the meeting, they came, and here was Charlie, and he was a tall, tan, nice-looking man, and he was sober, and I could see that. So here it was, we had sobriety. And it is wonderful, and it is different, and it's all those things, you know. And every night after dinner, sometimes he had dinner with us, Charlie would come and get John, and they'd go to a meeting. You know, they get up and say, "Well, it's time to go to a meeting. We'll see you at 11. And, that was fine, you know, for about a month. And then I started to think, it's still his show. He's still out every night. I'm stuck here at home with the kids, you know. And, of course, in a household full of kids, you know, right after dinner, it's nobody's turn to do the dishes. Nobody can find the shampoo. Can't find their homework. She wore my sweater today," and on and on. We even remembered little John, who was 6 years old, and the baby. Carolyn had said that he had to go and start filling the dishwasher too. And she said, "Get out there, little John, and start putting away the dish." Little John said, "I've got cramps." Yeah. we talked about it. Well, he said he couldn't understand why everybody laughed so much. Anyway, so I asked John, I said, is it really necessary to go to a meeting every night? He said, I'll check. Yeah. But then they began to invite me to come along to open meetings, you know. And now I have to tell you about the Elano Club in Anaheim. It was really downtown. I'd never even been on that street. And it was sort of a kind of old California bungalow. And there wasn't a chair in the place. There were 35 old sofas with sleazy bedspreads on them. And I can't even describe the smoke. I mean, you don't see that anymore. So here, you know, over the years, the sloshier John got, the more proper I got. You know, you sort of overcompensate. And here comes Miss Priss into this club, you know. I'd had some ideas about a club, but not this one. But, you know, that was the first gift to me from Alcoholics Anonymous. I just loved that place. I felt so safe and full of hope in there. And I could see those people had been heavy drinkers, and I could see they were sober, and I just loved it. I was so impressed. And all the big AA speakers came to speak at that place. We had a fellow named Norm Alpe. That was where I heard him. And Cliff Walker. And what's his name again? McGinnis. Alan McGinnis. And Chuck C. came. And Clancy came. He was 4 years sober. And funny and tragic and great. And there was a beautiful AA woman came to speak one Sunday. Her name was Marion Ford. She's gone now. And she came sweeping into this dump. I mean, let's face it, that's what it was. In her white cashmere coat, you know. And I, of course, immediately, can we put that coat not on one of those sofas, you know. Not to worry, she wore it, so. And John bought the book, big book of Alcoholics Anonymous right away, and I read it right away because I knew I could better help him with his program. And I loved it. I still love that big book. And I thought, oh, it's so plainly written. It's like an arrow into your heart, I thought to myself. And now Johnny asked me to quit my job and stay home, you know. And I threw that job over just like that. I wanted to be home when the kids got home from school. And then he has always been able to have his office at home, part of it. So he was always there. And Charlie didn't seem to have anywhere to go either, so he was there a lot too, you know. But I didn't care. They were going to work this beautiful spiritual program, you know. And said I could never hear them talk about it. I thought maybe there would be some written tests, you know, or something. But they just told a lot of funny stories, and they laughed a lot. And they discussed Charlie's automobile. He had an Austin Healey. That was very interesting. And I thought, I started to look this Charlie over, you know. I thought, I might have to pick another sponsor for John. You know. But then I figured it out. Johnny hadn't told Charlie what he'd put me through. You see, Charlie didn't know. So I'll tell you what I did. I did. I drove over to Charlie and Virginia's house on Sunday morning, and I told them everything. Everything. Palm Springs, the whole thing. They didn't say very much. I remember they looked at their shoes a lot. And it was soon after that So Charlie began to talk to me about some women he knew that met in the back room of that club. I didn't even know about the back room. And he said, I know you love these women. You know, they're very nice. And so that's how I came to Al-Anon. And I understood. And they told me this was for me. And they said we work the same 12 steps as the alcoholics do. And they said we don't talk about the alcoholic in the meetings. I had a little trouble with that. But, and of course we had some literature and book. We had two books at that time. So now I was in Al-Anon, you know, and I must say, I've heard UAAs talk about how difficult it can be to come in and start working these steps after you hit bottom. But you ought to try it coming in perfect. It is hard. What are you going to do when there's nothing wrong with you? I mean, there's nothing to work with. But I tried. And of course, with that back room, in the meantime, they're having their meeting out in the big room. And you can hear this laughter. The place would just rock with laughter. And I had to keep an ear on that, you know, and check on that. And I thought, I bet they're talking about us. You know, they're laughing about us. And I had more trouble with that. And you see, I was so glad that John was sober. But I hadn't figured on that he was going to be happy. It just burned me up. You know. And all this hugging and carrying on, you know. What are these people after they have torn everything up? Now they're going to be racing around like heroes out there. And I really was mad about the whole thing. And I can still remember when I first heard the do's and don'ts. We have that in Al-Anon. We have 9 do's and 10 don'ts. I'm not going to quote them all, but a couple of the do's are, do learn the facts about alcoholism, and do attend Al-Anon meetings often. Well, some of the don'ts are, don't try to dominate, scold, nag, scold, and complain. I thought that was interesting. And then it said, don't bring up the past. Don't lose your temper. Don't try to check up on the alcoholic. And on and on. And I thought, well, great. Isn't this going to make it cushy for the alcoholic? You know? And I thought, who writes this stuff? You know, I bet they wrote it. You know. And so it went. And we'd come in to the meeting, you know, to the big AA room, and there they would be, hello, John. Oh, you look great. How long is it? Wonderful. Hello, Karen. So, good friends. And I would come to my, I would drive to my Al-Anon meeting, and I'd say, please, God, let me hear something tonight. I was beginning to see and be able to tell the people who had program, as we say, you know, and how relaxed they were around their family and other people, and let other people be. And I wanted it, I really did, but I wasn't getting it. And then I'd come to the meeting, and I said, please, no, let me, I've got to hear something. So I'd come to the meeting, and I'd hear exactly what I needed, you know, and I knew it. I said, yeah, that's what I should do, or that's what I should stop doing. It was only 2 things, you know. And then I'd drive home, and I said, yeah, now I'm getting it, you know. And then, you know, when you're in the same meeting week after week, you get to know each other's story pretty well. And then I get closer to home, then I say, oh, that was wonderful what Mary said. But look what a mess her life is in. I forgot the whole thing, and I had to start out from scratch again, you know. And that's how I did it. I can even remember one morning I had tore into John about something, and You see, he didn't want to fight with me anymore. He was so happy in AA, you know, and loved it so. And I can remember when he said to me, "You know, Karen, maybe not even sobriety is going to help our marriage. Maybe we hurt each other too much." And for some reason I heard that, you know, because I used to be the one that talked about getting rid of him. But here I was thinking he's going to leave me if I don't shape him up. You know, he didn't say that, but I felt that. I had one thing that it used to work for me during the drinking. I thought it worked for me. And that was, I used to hold up to John how he was hurting the kids by never taking them anywhere, never teaching them things. And I knew I could get to him with this because John's father died when he was 8 years old. And I'd watch him play tennis with him or swim with him and sweat and shake, you know. And I thought, serves him right. And but now I was doing the same thing. But of course now I couldn't hold up the drinking anymore. But when you have a bunch of kids, they fight and cry. And then I'd say to John, "Yes, John, after all, you're an alcoholic and all that drinking must have damaged them." And Johnny wouldn't defend himself. He'd say, "Yes, Karen, I'm so sorry and I'm trying to do better." And you know, I knew what I was doing. I knew it was unfair. But I kept doing it over and over again. Finally, I talked to Myrna, my sponsor, about it. And I said, "Myrna, this is what I'm doing. And I can't stop." And Myrna said, "Karen, you're going to have to let go of the past. You can't fix the past. You can't fix it. Johnny can't fix it. Nobody can fix the past. The only way you can have a better past is to have a better present." And she said, "I think it's time you do your inventory." And she sort of stressed your, you know. She said, "It's time you take your fourth step." And I was always willing, you know. I read the fourth step, read the one in the AA 12 and 12, and I read what we had. And my whole reaction to the fourth step was, "What did I ever do? I stayed home and took care of the kids." And I told that to Myrna, and that was my fifth step. That's where I was, you know. And I drove to my meeting, and I had just done this thing again. And I came in, and I felt so alone and so isolated. And I thought, I don't even have a right to be in Al-Anon. They think I'm doing well, but I'm not the same way at home as I am in the meetings. You know, something happened to me. Something came back to me that had happened 5 years before sobriety, and we were in our second year on the program. John had to go to San Diego on a job, and he said, "You want to come along?" And I said, "I sure do." And for some reason, we took Katrina with us, and she was 3 years old at the time. Well, I had overheard something, and I figured the rest of it out by myself. And I had some accusations to make to John that morning. And you know, I cried and screamed and swore in that car all the way to San Diego. And John tried to calm me down, and little Katrina begged me to stop, and there was no stopping me. I was just insane with jealousy and rage. And we came to San Diego, and John took care of his work, and we drove home, and I did the same thing all the way home. I was just crazy. And when we got back to the house, my mother was there with the other kids, and I hopped out of that car, and I said, "Hi, how's everybody?" And you know, I had never once thought about those terrible hours. It had never bothered me. And then other things started to come back to me. That trip to Palm Springs when Johnny was drunk and I thought he shouldn't drive. But then a cool thought in the back of my mind said, "Oh yes, we'll go. If something happens on the road, maybe that'll scare him." Now you know, I was the children's champion. I was sane and sober. But that's what I did. And then another time I had taken my girl shopping on a Saturday morning, and we left the baby at home, and we went shopping and we had lunch. And then on the way home, I thought, oh my God, I hope the baby is all right. And then I thought, well, if he isn't. And we got home, and Johnny was passed out in the lawn swing, and the baby was sitting on the steps of the pool playing. And I was in my glory that afternoon. You know, I blamed that whole thing on John. And of course, by that time, John was a daily drinker. He was a morning drinker. And I knew that. Usually on Saturday, he got up early and got drunk and passed out and woke up in the afternoon. I knew that. So these were some of the things. And on that trip home to Sweden, our parents were so happy to see us. And my parents, this was their first grandchild, and we were going to have a celebration. My father had bought tickets. We were going north to see my mother's people, and it was going to be such a wonderful time. Well, he was a little drunk that Saturday, and I created such a scene that he couldn't come with us. You know, I made him stay behind. And I can remember my mother on the train trying to hide that she was crying. I mean, the whole thing was destroyed. So this was me. This was me. Myrna had said, you have to forgive John. Well, I knew now. First, I knew I couldn't pass myself off as a victim any longer. This was my stuff. And as far as me forgiving John, I understood, as crazy as I was, I understood whoever should forgive John had forgiven him, because he was changing. He was a different man. But now I needed forgiveness. So I told this to Myrna, and I had met Elsa Chamberlain at that time, and I went down to see her and told her, and she helped me so much and said, well, what do you think we have the sixth step for? Now you're ready to ask God to help you to change. So, this all happened a long time ago, as you can see. And all our children are married now, or have been married, God, for many, many years. And only one is in the program. None of the others. Well, Katrina is the alcoholic. She has 17 years. And she was troubled before she... And she first came into Al-Anon. Johnny said, why don't you go to Al-Anon? It helped Mom so much. So she came to Al-Anon. And we used to come to bring her to the big AA meeting in Laguna. And of course, she was about 20, I guess, and then the cute as a button. And she got caught in there. And there was one particular fellow. He was a Russian, of Russian descent, a very intense fellow. And he started to run smaller and smaller circles around Katrina. and John and I didn't know if we liked this. We didn't quite know. I mean, this fellow had been on drugs. You know. I mean, John and I wanted a pure alcoholic for our little girl. It's nothing like being uppity in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, of course, they were just down here. What is it, 24 years they've been married. And he turned out to be a prince, you know. He's a wonderful father and provider and all that. I have maybe 5 minutes left, do I? I want to tell you a story. There was a woman, an AA woman in Laguna, who wasn't fond of Al-Anon, especially not me. And she called us the pastel ladies. I thought, you idiot. You wouldn't stand for a month, but we live with it for years, you know, and that is the truth. I mean, she got drunk when she broke a fingernail, you know. Anyway, so I want to tell you how powerful Al-Anon is. You know, this happened right when I was new in Al-Anon. One of my Al-Anon friends said, I have to go to work, but I want you to make this 12-step call for me. And I said, okay. I knew one never said no to a request. So I went to knock on this door, and the woman opened it a little bit. And I said, I'm here from Al-Anon. And she let me in, and all the drapes were drawn in her house, and it's very dim in there. And she spoke to me in whispers, and she was married to this very successful commercial builder, and she was much afraid of him. She was so fearful. And of course, nothing had happened to me yet, to me personally. But I had sense enough to ask if she wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And she did, and we went that night. And she heard something and felt something in that meeting. And we began to go to Al-Anon together. And I would come and pick her up. Then he was gone that weekend, but then later when I picked her up, he would be out there on the front porch, you know, glaring at me. And she just loved it. And I can remember she signed off for a business course at Adult Education in Anaheim. And she had a long green Buick automobile that she had charged up again. She hadn't driven for several years because she was afraid. And of course, I had already heard in AA that you don't promote this thing, but I threw that rule out. And we told John to go and call on this guy, you know, and he did. And he told John, if you ever show your face here again, I'll kill you, he said. So that didn't work. And this man took his shirt off and showed John he'd had several back operations, and he was actually on morphine and booze. But his wife and I kept going to Al-Anon. But then one night when I came to pick her up, he had had it. I mean, he was out there on the porch and he was livid. And he said, if you get in that car with a silly woman one more time, you needn't come back, he said. I'll change the locks, I'll close the accounts, you'll be begging in the streets. And he was just screaming. And I sat in my car, you know, he said, that woman has broken up our marriage, she has broken up our home, you know, and on and on. And I sat in my car and I thought, yeah, I'll go back in with him. This was a dumb idea from the beginning. But she didn't. She just stood there. And then when he drew his breath a moment, she said, I'm sorry, but I have to go to my meeting. And we drove off. But now he could see he wasn't afraid of him anymore. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to one of those stupid meetings. And then I don't want to hear about this nonsense anymore. But it was October, and it was time for the Southern California Convention, and it was held in Anaheim. And we took them there on Sunday morning. You know how Sunday morning is after a convention. The whole place was vibrating with love and gratitude and all the fun people have had. And there were about 4,500 people there. And we stood in that lobby, and he didn't run. He stood there. But he was like he was made of ice. So we went into the meeting, and Chuck C. spoke that morning. And he sat through all the man and his wife, they sat through all the preliminaries, the steps and all that going on. But 10 minutes into Chuck's talk, we saw it happen to this guy. It was the most amazing thing you could... It was as something fell off of him, and he reached over and took his wife's hand, and it was so amazing. And he died several years ago, and he had 18 years of sobriety. And those two people helped so many people. They were so great. And this is what we get invited to, we Al-Anons, you know. This is what can happen to us. And, you know, that woman had found her inner strength in the Al-Anon meetings. And she was able to let go of him, to stop pleading, stop begging him, to stop being afraid, you know. And that's what we have. So when I was newly married, and I truly had the world by the tail with this beautiful man who didn't drink, and I knew I was going to be on top all the time. If anyone had spoken to me about alcoholism, I would have said, no way, not in my life. And then again, toward the end there of the alcoholism, it gets so dark and frightening and lonely. If anyone had told me about this way of life, I wouldn't have understood. There was nothing in me that said that I would want to try for something like this. So I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Alan, to all of you. Thank you.